get a resonant lens so that all those bounces stay in balance, in phase. That's an ordinary standing wave antenna, and 95% of the antennas in the world, of the 5,000 antennas, are standing wave structures. There's a whole other class of antennas that are much more rarely used called traveling wave antennas. The traveling wave antenna means the signal goes down to the wire or the conductor or the radiator of the antenna essentially only one time. At the far end of the antenna is a terminating resistor. Frequently it's a number like 600 ohms, where the signal left over gets absorbed. In order for a traveling wave antenna to work well, let me drop. It must be a large number of wavelengths long. If it's just one simple piece of wire parallel to the ground, multiple wavelengths long, with a terminating resistor at the far end, it's called a Beveridge antenna. Mr. Beveridge invented that kind of an antenna. And it does fire in the direction of the wire, not broadside. The wire has to be multiple wavelengths long, like 3, 4, 5, 10 wavelengths long, to work well. And as the wire gets longer and longer, you develop a little bit more gain in the end fire direction. And if you didn't put a terminating resistor on the end, the signal that's left over would reflect back on the wire, and therefore you would develop a back lobe. But the antenna has primarily one forward lobe if the wire is multiple wavelengths long with proper termination. That's a Beveridge antenna if you do it with one wire. If you do it with two wires in a diamond shape, multiple wavelengths long on each leg of the diamond, that's the so-called rhombic antenna. It does have the exact same characteristic. The signal goes down those two wires, that diamond shape of two wires. It's a, call it a dipole, it's a, you know, heavily bent forward and into a diamond shape, where it spreads out for a while and then comes back together where the terminating resistor is at the far end. That rhombic antenna, primarily the signal goes down that wire once, multiple wavelengths of each of those sides, and then gets terminated. And once again, if you don't put in the terminating resistor, then you lose your front-to-back ratio. Let me drop. So a traveling wave antenna is one class of antennas which has a rather clean antenna pattern. The peak of the gain is in the direction of the wire, not broadside. But to work well, it has to be a relatively large number of wavelengths long on each leg. And that's the rub. If you did that on, say, 80 meters, the antenna might be something like 1,000 feet long or longer to work well. Yes, if you did it on 10 meters, it would be considerably shorter, but multiple wavelengths. In the case of a dipole, a standing wave antenna, half wavelengths tip-to-tip works very well. In case of a ground plane, quarter wave from the counterpoise to the tip is, again, a standing wave structure. The signal bounces back and forth. So, traveling wave structures are very nice if you've got enough real estate to make the wire a large number of wavelengths long. If you try to build a Beveridge antenna where the wire is only half a wavelength long, for instance, you'd be fairly unhappy with the efficiency. I don't think you'd get more than a 20% efficiency, so to speak. The rest of the signal would be going into the terminating resistor, and you wouldn't be getting very much gain. You wouldn't be getting a very desirable pattern. Let me drop it. The very desirable peak in the pattern, in the direction of the wire, parallel to the wire, not broadside. That happens when the wire is a large number of wavelengths long with that terminating resistor on the so-called Beveridge antenna. So I've seen your property. I know I was involved in that an installation with Barry on your antenna. You don't have enough property to make a multiple wavelength structure to do this, Rich. As I see it, you'd have to buy a couple more acres of property to be able to build this kind of an antenna and get the high performance out of it. N2EL, K2LIW in the Texan. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EL. I wasn't sure. I was afraid you were going to tell me that. Yes, it would be very nice, but a lot of things in life would be very nice and can't
WMB, please.
All right, WB2, blank, blank, blank. Give me those call letters again, your name, and proceed with your comment. I got the other two. First person, go ahead.
Whiskey Bravo 2, Alpha Hotel Kilowatt, Chet, C-A-T-T. I primarily operated 160 meters for about 20 years recently, multi-year temporarily. But I found out that for receiving purposes, I went to a shielded receiving loop, 5 foot square, 160, and that became my primary antenna. And I was able to find out very quickly that if you transmit on one antenna and use that receiving loop for receiving, you can rotate it, and it's very broadbanded all the way around, with the exception of a couple of degrees where it's a high attenuation, like 30, 40 degrees off the side. And if Rich has a situation where in a particular band he has a lot of noise, he can build a very small receiving loop, shielded receiving loop, and he can turn it in the direction of where the noise is coming from and get rid of the noise. I built one for 75 meters, which is only 18 inches square, so he could certainly build one, and they work very well inside the house. You don't even have to even put it outside. So let's say, if he wants to work 20 meters, he could build one on his desk and use a shielded receiving loop for receiving. That was my comment. Go ahead, Dick, WB2AHK.
Yeah, the whole class of loop antennas, where you usually set up that loop where the plane of the loop is perpendicular to the earth, and now you rotate it. It's a kind of direction-finding antenna, and quite often it is considerably less than a wavelength in diameter. In your particular loop antenna, Chet, I got two questions. One, did it have only one turn or multiple turns? Two, I am guessing there was a tuning control built into the antenna to resonate it, a variable capacitor quite possibly. And number three, I am guessing it was rather narrowband. In other words, if you tuned it for 3875 and you QSY'd to 3900, my guess is you had to do some retuning of the antenna. It's a relatively narrowband, I believe. Let's see how much of that is true. WB2AHK, K2RIW, go ahead, Chet.
WB2AHK. No, not at all. It's very broadbanded for 160. It's a Lou McCoy antenna. Lou McCoy. And it's extremely broadbanded at 160. I can use it for the whole band. And I had it in my house once, testing it, when the first one I built. And I was listening on it to an S9 signal of the two stations talking to each other. And I turned it around. Right behind me, I had on a little support, and I was able to null out the whole station in a very few degrees of travel of turning it, where I didn't even hear the stations anymore. It works on noise that way too. That's far away signals, but locally, you can tune out local noise sources. That's what I've done here. I've had some noise in the area, and I was successful in pointing it in such a way that I could almost completely attenuate the local noise source, and I don't have to rotate the antenna to pick up anybody else in directions not where I know about the interfering signal. So, no, it's not true. It's a single turn Lou McCoy antenna, shielded receiving loop is made out of RG58 or RG59 with a little cap on the bottom. You make it resonant very easily, and it's a single turn. Over.
Okay, the single turn of RG58, I think you said it was something like 15 inches in diameter. Sounds like it's a round antenna. Sounds like you set it up perpendicular, the plane of the antenna perpendicular to the earth. And was it fed with an inner small loop? How did you excite the resonant loop, Chet? Go ahead.
top. It's a square antenna. On 160, it's 5 foot square. And it's square. And it's at the top, you open up the shield. It does have a center conductor crossing. At the bottom, it's the opposite thing. You break open the center conductor, and you put a cap across it. And you put the proper amount of capacitance, and you can get it resonant. And hook up the coax right there, and it wasn't very difficult to make. I have one in my garage right now. I built about 5 of them, and they all work the same. So you can make those little things resonant. As I said, I have a 75-meter one on my chimney, and it's only 18 inches square. And it's quite simple. No two loops at all. Just a single piece of coax, and connect the feed line at the bottom. And you could look on the in the antenna manual, look up Lou McCoy's shielded antenna loop, shielded loop antenna. Single turn, real easy, gets rid of the noise.
Okay, there's some missing information in what you've given us, Lou. Let's talk about the 160. You made a square of coax, 5 foot square. The input coax goes up. We'll say across the bottom, up one side, across the top, down the third side, and then back to the beginning. Did the center conductor and shield of the piece of coax that's in this 5 foot square loop, center conductor and shield, maybe are connected together, maybe are grounded back at the shield at the bottom. At the top, you opened up the shield, spread the shield, in other words, all the way around, up at the top, and put a tuning capacitor across it. Is that approximately the way you set it up, Chet? Over to you, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's it. The bottom, the top is, the shield is open, about a half inch. Not critical, 3/4 inch. I'm leaving the center conductor going top, across, you know, continuous at the top. At the bottom, the shield is continuous from one end, one side to the other. At the bottom, you break open the center conductor of the coax that's going around, the square antenna. You break open the center conductor. You hook up the feeding coax directly to one side of the bottom on the left side, and you put a cap across it to make it resonant to the center conductor going the opposite direction. It's very simple. Everyone could define that very easily in any antenna handbook. The Lou McCoy single turn receiving loop. And you can make it for like a 20 meter antenna, probably like only 12 inches square or something like that. Oh, the important thing I left out is that you lose a lot. You need a preamp. You need a preamp. You're going to lose about 30 dBs of gain. So you have to have like a Mico preamp. But the interesting thing is that when you have a preamp, normally when you have an antenna with noise and you hook up a preamp, all you do is also boost up the noise at the same time. In the receiving loop, as what I just mentioned, at first you think the antenna is not working because it's so quiet, but you do lose about 30 dBs and you boost it up using a preamp, and it doesn't boost the noise. It does boost the signal. It's amazing. Signal just pop right out. Relatively noise-free. It's amazing. Over.
Now, there's a variable capacitor that tunes this loop antenna. You didn't make it clear as to the two leads of the variable capacitor. Where do they go from or to? I have the impression that when you broke open the coax shield at the top of the antenna, at first I thought that's where you put a capacitor, and you said, no, you didn't put a capacitor there. The capacitor is at the bottom. Okay, the tuning capacitor goes from where to where? How big was that capacitor, and how sharp is that tuning? So where does that tuning capacitor go, Chet? Over to you, K2LIW.
All right, the capacitor is at the bottom. At the top, everyone wants to envision a square antenna made out of coax. Each, let's say 160, it was 5 foot square. We'll just talk about that for a moment. At the top, horizontal part of the square antenna, you break open the the shield, to cut off the shield in the middle top section, leaving just the center conductor. All right? So the shield is not continuing along the top. At the bottom, you open up the coax on the bottom horizontal section. You get at it. You leave the shield connected on the bottom. So the bottom section, the horizontal section, is continuing. Now you have the center conductor in your hand. You break it open. Now you got the center conductor going. You cut it. Center conductor goes to the left, and the center conductor on the other side goes to the right. You hook up your feed line to the shield at the bottom. You solder the shield from your coax to the shield on the bottom. You take the center conductor of your feed coax. You hook up a capacitor. I'll give you the numbers later for 160. But you take a capacitor from the center conductor of the feed line, feeding it. And that goes to the right-hand side center conductor. What you'll find is, depending on band, of course, you have to keep these things small to make them noise-free, so you don't want to build a 5-foot square antenna for 20 meters. You got to keep them small. The key is to make the antenna small. So for, as I mentioned before, the 75-meter version is only like 18 inches square.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
But the important thing is, you could have a variable capacitor across it. You could, depending, I know I built it for 75 meters and 160, but on 160 I need about 250 pumps approximately. I have a lot of those capacitors, and I experimented, you know, with antenna meter, MFJ antenna meter. And I found it somewhere around, if I remember, about 250 pumps. That goes from the center conductor of your feed line over to the right-hand side center conductor, which was cut apart. And you just adjust enough capacitance to make a resonant in the center of the band. And with my case, on 160, I set it for 1900, 1.9, and was able to do the whole band without any retuning and no deterioration of signals. I didn't notice anything. So 160 was easy for me. I built about 5 of them. Over.
Okay, we've got most of the picture you've given us, Chet. The schematic diagram at the bottom where the feed line feeds the antenna. You did not make it clear where the shield of the feed line goes, where the center conductor, we almost have that. The center conductor of the transmission line apparently goes straight to the variable capacitor. The other side of the variable capacitor goes to the center conductor of the loop that has made the full 360 degrees all the way around that square. We don't yet know where the shield of the looped RG58 goes, and we don't, we're not sure where the shield of the transmission line goes. So the schematic diagram at the bottom, you haven't given us enough words so that we've got a picture of that one, Chet. Over to you, K2LAW.
Okay. The shield of the feed line feeding it and the shield of both sides of the bottom horizontal section all connect together. You're not breaking open the shield on the bottom horizontal section of the square. The shield of the antenna itself continues without a break on the bottom, continues. But you have it opened up. You got the plastic of the coax opened up so you could see the shield. And you take the coax feed line and just solder it to the continuation of the shield that's going, you know, straight ahead without a break. The only thing you break on the bottom is the center conductor. The center conductor. And you feed the one side of the... let's see how we do this. One side of the portion on the right, you have a cap going back to the feed line, and that will also connect to the left-hand side center conductor. So the center conductor at the bottom connects to the center conductor of the feed line right there, and in, a tap goes from the center conductor going towards the right, and that's how you resonate it, and you solder that to the center conductor of the piece on the right, which was exposed, and it was already cut off before, so that you can get at it. So the center conductor of the feed line is connected to the center conductor of the left side, and you have a cap going from the center conductor of the feed line coax. It's broken apart, and you put a cap there, and then to the right, it heads to the right center conductor where you resonate it with the right another picofarads.
Okay, this is a relatively low-gain receiving antenna from your description. It needed a 20 or 30 decibel preamplifier. So this is a receiving loop, somewhat like a direction finder. As you rotated that loop, you could get a very deep null. Let me think now. I am guessing the very deep null occurred broadside. In other words, if the plane of the loop was east-west and the plane of the loop is perpendicular to the earth, you would have a deep null to the north and south is my guess. And I, from your description, this is a pure receiving antenna, and I think it is not intended for transmitting. Is that true, Chet? WB2EHK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's only for receiving, for people who want to receive and have noise situations where they want to attenuate the noise dramatically in a very few degrees of, omnidirectional signal reception. Let's say you have a noise source at 170 degrees from your house. You would turn the edge of the antenna, not broadside, the edge is where the null is in this particular way it's built, and the edge is where it would go to the noise source and attenuate it by, probably 50, 60 dBs for only a few degrees of travel. It's very, very sharp. The noise is the attenuation is extremely sharp, only for a few degrees of direction of turning the antenna. So you get broadband coverage all the way around, maybe about 350-something degrees with hardly any deterioration of signal. But at that very last few degrees, right off the edge of the antenna, you get a tremendous attenuation, and that's how you can get rid of a noise source. I've had a few around here, and I was able to, my own TV, my plasma TV, was giving me trouble on 160, and I was able to orientate my antenna and null out my plasma TV. I'm on the second floor, and I was able to null out my plasma TV, my 50-inch plasma TV's noise, by rotating the antenna on my pole, which is, the antenna was mounted on my pole. So I was able to get rid of my own TV plasma noise by turning the antenna.
Antenna was depleted there, or do you think it got dropped in the more antenna book. Over to you, Chet.
Got a feeling it might still be there. The beauty of the antenna is it's, as you say, you know, some loop antennas, you need that second loop inside it to resonate it and all that. This is so this is not the transmitting. This is the thing. It's for receiving. And it's so simple. I built my 160 antenna with some PVC pipe that I got at Home Depot. It cost me like, I think the whole thing with the coax and everything, you can build it for $10 for 160. You buy some 1-inch PVC, you make, and you connect it in like a, mount it in an X-frame, and you just attach the RG58U or 59U, doesn't matter, you know, on 165 foot square. It's very simple to make. It's very cheap, and more like a 20 meter antenna. Geez, you can put it right on your desk. If N2EO has a favorite band, you could build one of these. If these are single band antennas, that's what you have to understand. I mean, you might be able to have a variable cap and make it resonate on other bands, but that's not it. You have to really build it, change the size of the actual frame of the antenna. Let's say, for instance, 75 meters is 18 inches square, maybe 20 meters is 12 inches square. You got to keep reducing the size of the antenna for the higher bands, otherwise you don't get the resulting noise attenuation. So the resonating capacitor is only used after you shape down the size of the entire antenna for the band in question. So that's a very important thing. The bigger they make these things, the larger you make these things. Let's say if you tried to use the 160 antenna on 20, you wouldn't get the noise reduction.
It's repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's very important to keep the size of the antenna very small. Very, very small in relation to wavelength. And that's how you get rid of the noise.
Great, fine. That's a fascinating antenna, Chet. Now, we've got some further questions or comments from both John and Barry in that order. John, KC2WGB, go right ahead. K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yes, my question is, originally Rich was talking about antenna, a long wire with a terminating resistor. My question is, what determines the value of the terminating resistor? Does it vary with the length of the antenna? Back to you, Dick.
I think you could say the answer is almost no. In the case of a single wire parallel to the ground, some reasonable altitude above the ground, multiple wavelengths long, the terminating resistor at the far end going to ground is in the vicinity of 600 ohms for a so-called beverage antenna. So it's called a traveling wave antenna. Let me drop. It's called a traveling wave antenna because that signal goes down the wire only once, and whatever is left over after going down multiple wavelengths of wire gets terminated. And if you remove the termination, you would start developing a back lobe. So now, if you built the antenna 10 wavelengths long and then built another one 20 wavelengths long, we'd get a little bit more gain. In both cases, you'd still be using something close to a 600 ohm resistor. Not a supercritical resistor, but that's the approximate impedance out there of the wave on the end of that beverage antenna. Does that make some sense, John? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, it does. I was just wondering exactly what you said. If you had a long wire and then you doubled the length, I wonder if it would affect that resistor as much. But because of the value of that resistor compared to the impedance of the antenna, I don't think it matters. Okay, thank you very much. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Jim. And I think, Barry, you've talked about building a beverage antenna from time to time, using not only your property, but the property of the next-door neighbor. N2 Moon Bounce, K2RIW. Go ahead, Barry. Maybe Barry got called away. And if he comes back, we'll pick up with him. The next person on our list was John, KC2QIW. Go right ahead, John, K2RIW in the TechNet. I said John, I meant Joe. Go ahead.
Roger. Yeah, you just read my mind. Yeah, the name here is Joe, and my uncle and my aunt, they own 22 acres of land upstate New York over there. So you could have a whole antenna farm up there, 22 acres of land. Okay, Dick. So my question to you is, this February I have to renew my amateur radio license. Do I have to wait until February? Do I have to wait until February to renew it, or can I do it like in November or December? Back to you, Dick.
Here I'm not sure, but I'm going to make a statement, and you guys can correct me. At one time, you could renew your license within, I think it was within 60 days of when it runs out. At one time, it was within 60 days you're allowed to do a renewal. I wonder if that's still the number being used now. Do you guys on frequency have a correction on that? Please give me a call, letters, and name right now. K2LIW in the Tech Van.
It's 3 months. N2HVR.
Okay, thank you. N2HVR. You're saying within 3 months of the end of your license, you're allowed to renew. Mr. HVR, where did you read that? And you believe that's the number that's being used today. HVR, please give us your name. K2RW, go right ahead, sir.
Hi, Dick. The name is Nick, November India Charlie Kilo, and the call is November 2, Hotel Victor Rio. I'm doing this much, that's why I know. I've been on the website, and I actually called the FCC, and they said, as long as you do it with... I wanted to do it sooner, but they told me I had to do it within 3 months of the expiration date.
Very fine, Nick, and thank you. So that's 90 days instead of 60 days. Looks like we've got an answer. It looks like Nick talked to the Friendly Candy Company directly. He got it from the horse's mouth, Joe. KC2QIW. K2IW, got it, Joe.
Yeah, roger that. Roger that. Yeah, I'll write this down in my logbook, keep it noted, and so I guess I could do it in November. And that's about it for today. Love you guys, and thank you very much. And pass it over back to you, Dick.
Okay, good luck with that project, Joe. Frank, WA2, Victor Bravo Zulu. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Frank. K2RIW listening. My name is Dick.
Roger, K2RIW, WA2VBZ. Thank you very much, Dick. I have a quick question over here. I live in Queens. I have one of these postage stamp properties, and it's a ranch house, so anything that I put is going to definitely be low. And right now, I put up a G5RV Junior antenna. I've got it where it's approximately an inverted V at about 150 degrees. I've been testing the antenna with an antenna analyzer, and at 20 meters, I have a 1.4 to 1, so that's doing well. The other bands, obviously, are going to have to be tuned by my auto-tuner. I'm running an Icon 718 with an auto-tuner. My question is, I've been reading so many different articles about whether a choke or a balm is necessary. And I did read something somewhere that one person had used the MFJ 918 one-to-one balm. And I was wondering if I would need that, if it would improve my my antenna situation, or it's just a waste of time. Over to you.
In almost all cases, if you're using a reasonable quality balm, B-A-L-U-N, N for Nancy, so it's sometimes spelled, it stands for balanced to unbalanced, but the word, the basic word is balanced, B-A-L-U-U-N or U-N, as I said, the list, and the letter is N for Nancy, not M for Mary. Quite a few people run into that minor problem. So a balance definitely helps to make sure that you're not radiating any signal on the coax cable, the transmission line. You'd like to have the transmission line not be part of the antenna, because it makes the pattern different, makes the Vizwire different. And also, the G5RV, most people are reasonably happy with it, except on 10 meters, depending on whether or not the open wire line portion of the G5RV was used on your particular model, seems to make a significant difference on 10 meters. A few people have complained the standing wave ratio on 10 meters can be quite high. Other than that, they're reasonably pleased with it. So I do recommend using the balun. It's not going to crash and burn if you don't use the balun, but you get a slightly purer situation where it's a dipole-like antenna. Let me drop it. In the case of a pure, ordinary half-wave dipole, good common sense would lead you to believe you take the transmission line, feed the shield to the left-hand side of the dipole, feed the center conductor to the right side of the dipole, and you're feeding it, so to speak. Unfortunately, the signal that's on the left-hand side, when you're receiving or transmitting, some of it gets coupled to the coax cable, and the outside shield of the transmission line becomes part of the antenna, and that affects radiation, visual, and so on. To put a balloning-like device there makes it act like you've got open wire line or twin lead feeding it, and it becomes thoroughly balanced. What your balun does, it acts like a one-to-one transformer where the secondary winding is thoroughly floating, and at one instant of time, if it's feeding plus 50 volts to the right side of the dipole, it's feeding minus 50 volts to the left side at that instant, and then a half wave later it's reversed in polarity. So the balun gives you that function, and it makes sure the shield is not part of the radiator. So temporarily you can certainly set it up without the balun, but at a later time you'll get higher performance when you do use the balun. Over to you, Frank, to be to Victor Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
Roger, thank you on that, Dick. That sounds like a good idea. Right now, I'm still in the process of finalizing the antenna run. Basically, it's like I am getting good readings. Ironically, on 10 meters, on 28 megs, I've got like a 2.6. If for some reason 10 meters is bad, I also have an old dipole 10 meter that I can use that which has worked well in the past. But yeah, that was my main question, because like I'm getting so many conflicting reports about whether a balun, I'll pronounce it right one of these days, is necessary or not. And I truly appreciate the help. K2RIW, WA2VBC.
As you continue with those experiments, with or without balun and setting up that antenna, come back and tell us about it periodically, Frank, as to how it's going and what you've observed. Because your situation is quite similar to what an awful lot of people have for their particular QTH. Next person on the list was Joe, W2RYY, who was doing some rather unusual field strength measurements of noise by using an FM receiver. Under normal circumstances, that's a tough way to go. And Joe was realizing that by using a signal generator, coupling some signal for calibration reasons into his FM receiver while he drove it around in his automobile, it's a very crafty way of making a quantitative measurement of noise. And so we had quite a description of that last week, and wonder how things have gone with that process this week, Joe. Also, you offered a piece of electronics to me. I thank you. I may not take you up on that deal. I already own an IC-R7000, which covers that frequency regen, so I've got that covered. And my house is filled with electronics as it is, so I'm a little bit afraid to add something else to it. W2LYY, K2LIW, you got it, Joe. WA2LYY. Maybe he got called away. In which case, if that's true, we'll go over to the next person and come back to Joe when he comes back. One last call. Are you there, Joe?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we're waiting for you, Joe.
Okay, here goes. This is more of a curiosity type of question I have than really anything else. It doesn't directly apply to amateur, you know, practices, but it has to do with radio within itself, okay?
Okay, you're asking me to say okay. I will say okay. Please proceed, Joe. Okay?
Copy that. Say you have RF energy being transmitted from a source, and it's occupying a number of megahertz of spectrum space, and this energy is, say you measure it with a receiving apparatus, it's coming in at a certain level. How does that level equate to looking at it a different way, as in dBm per hertz? Is there a direct formula that converts the signal level you're receiving, where you're measuring this from, to what it would actually be if you break it down to a much, much smaller bandwidth, and across the entire thing? In this case, that would be the entire, you know, space of 6 megahertz down to something where else only a few kilohertz apart. Is it direct? Is that a linear relationship as far as converting that signal from one to the other? Or is there something else involved in, like, a logarithmic type of problem answer to it?
To a small degree here, Joe, we're mixing up two slightly related but different concepts. When it comes to a sinusoidal-like narrowband signal, like I put my key down at 14.1 megahertz, and I'm radiating a CW signal key down. That signal, depending on my antenna gain and how far I am away in the receiving site, I'm receiving some amount of signal strength, and that signal strength can be rated in watts per square meter, milliwatts per square centimeter, or volts per meter. So these are the usual units used for measuring signal strength. But if now I'm looking at a high stability oscillator on a spectrum analyzer, and every oscillator, no matter how well it's made, has a little bit of residual FM or a little bit of residual phase noise in the oscillator. So if you had the most ideal spectrum analyzer in the world and you looked at that signal, you'd expect it to be a pure vertical line on the spectrum analyzer. The horizontal scale, we'll say, is 100 kc wide, and at 14.1 megahertz, you'd expect to see this vertical line. Or you spread it out, you know, you use your higher dispersion settings of your spectrum analyzer, and you realize that so-called vertical line really is a small mountain. It's got side lobes, so to speak. In the vicinity of the side lobes, you rate the quality of the oscillator, its spectral purity. Let me drop. If this is the most ideal oscillator in the world, there would be nothing but a pure vertical line, and you wouldn't be able to see any skirts. Every realistic oscillator with enough dispersion on an ideal spectrum analyzer, you're going to see skirts. You're going to see the signal falling off in the beginning 9 dB per octave, later on 6 dB per octave, later on 3 dB per octave, as you get further and further away from the center frequency. Therefore, you rate the spectral purity as a noisy signal when you're rating those side lobes. When you tune, let me pick a number, 100 kilohertz above or below the center frequency, how far did that skirt fall off? It might have fallen off on your spectrum analyzer screen by, we'll say, 90 or 100 decibels, but your spectrum analyzer, you're setting it with a certain resolution bandwidth when you made that measurement. If it was, for instance, a 1 hertz filter, and you looked at the skirt 100 kc above or below, and it's 90 dB down, you would say that this particular oscillator has a spectral purity rating of minus 90 dBc per hertz. dB with reference to the center frequency, dB with reference to carrier, that's why they call it dBc. 90 dB down, measured with a 1 hertz filter, 100 kc away, that is a certain rating of spectral purity. You might also take another reading 1 megahertz away, and maybe it's going to be 110 dB down. So because a skirt is essentially a noisy signal, and noisy signals are always measured as some amount of power per bandwidth, that's why that reading looks like that. So it's a spectral purity measurement. Now let me drop. Usually that criteria is used when you're measuring the quality of an oscillator. But there's nothing to stop you from taking a signal of that oscillator that has been transmitted over the air and measuring it in a similar manner. In fact, when it comes to the rating section in QST magazine for pieces of electronics, and they give you a purity measurement, in other words, a key down at 20 meters will tell you how far down are the skirt side lobes of the noise coming out of the transmitter. It's really spectral purity measurement. By the way, depending on the quality of your particular spectrum analyzer, if the local oscillator of your spectrum analyzer doesn't have very high quality in this spectral purity measurement, dBc per hertz at some amount of offset, if the local oscillator on your spectrum analyzer is not good enough, the signal you display will look like it has those side lobes, and maybe you're measuring the side lobes of your spectrum analyzer's oscillator as opposed to the side lobes of the signal you want to measure. The two get mixed together, and the side lobe noises, they add in a particular manner. So, dBc per hertz is a parameter of quality of an oscillator, how much residual phase or frequency modulation it has. This is not an easy one to understand, Joe. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, wait for the beeps. K-2-R-I-W and TechNet. You got it, Joe.
I know it's not easy to understand, but it doesn't sound like you're directly answering the question I was looking for. Maybe you want to go in a different direction or something? It doesn't sound like you're answering the question that I was looking for.
I think you were asking, how is dBc per hertz used? I gave a description of dBc per hertz. If you're measuring signal strength, it's measured in dBm per square meter or in volts per meter. So signal strength is one set of units. Spectral purity is another set of units. When somebody talks about dBc per hertz, he's talking about the quality of an oscillator or the residual FM of a transmitter. So similar sounding, but two very different measurements. I don't know what else you want to hear, Joe. Rephrase your question. You got it, Joe, K2RIW.
Okay. Say across a particular piece of spectrum, 6 megahertz worth of space, you have a television signal that's digital in nature. And if you look across the entire 6 megahertz, you're supposed to see, if it's fairly flat, about the same level of energy. And say this level of energy that you receive, if you have your bandwidth set high enough on your analyzer to capture it correctly, happens to be maybe a reading like minus 60 dBm. If you go backwards and break that down to looking at through a smaller bandwidth, how does the relationship change? That's what I guess I'm looking at. Across a narrow bandwidth signal, how does that signal spread over 6 megahertz? How does it really look if you're looking across a bandwidth of, say, 10 kilohertz or 5 kilohertz worth of bandwidth?
Okay, that time you gave us a lot of the missing information that you had, but you didn't give it to us on the first transmission. In the case of what I'm going to call broadband noise-like signal, it's a very complicated method of modulation. Your 8 VSB digital television over-the-air transmission, when you look at it, it looks like Bart's haircut. In other words, it's 6 megahertz wide. It's got a flat top performance to it, very steep fall off at the lower edge and the upper edge that are 6 megs apart. And inside of this very complicated digital signal, to your spectrum analyzer, it looks like a noisy signal. So it's a noise signal where the noise has been spread over exactly 6 megacycles. It's been put through an extremely sharp brick wall filter, so to speak. Now, that noise-like signal, like any other kind of noise signal, must be measured in power per bandwidth. So dBm per megahertz, dBm per kilohertz, dBm per hertz. If you first measure that signal with, let's say, 100 kilohertz res bandwidth on your spectrum analyzer, and you got a certain power reading, and then you went down to a 10 kilohertz bandwidth, in the exact power is definitely related in a linear manner to the bandwidth of your measurement. So let me drop. When you flip over to the 10kc filter instead of the 100kc filter on your spectrum analyzer, assuming the spectrum analyzer has the exact same amount.
Repeater, timeout.
Assuming the spectrum analyzer has the exact same amount of internal gain on the 100 kHz filter and the 10 kHz filter, if they both have the same insertion loss, those filters, then it should fall off directly as a function of bandwidth. So a noise-like signal, and although it's very complicated digital waveform, it looks noise-like. You go from 100 kc to 10 kc, it'll fall off by 10 dB. You go from 10 kc to 1 kc, it'll fall off another 10 dB. So noise-like signals have to be measured in power per bandwidth. I wonder if that's what you're looking for, Joe. From E2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It sounds like it. What I'm driving at is really with some of these commercial frequencies that are up around the low end of the 470 band. In other words, it's based from 470 to 488. Is our channels 14, 15, and 16. And there are commercial services up in this area using those frequency bands. I guess what I'm getting at is if you see a signal across 6 megahertz that's normally not there, but because of propagation, you get ducting happening, and all of a sudden the signal may be 50, 60 decibels higher than you normally see it, what does that do to the bandwidth of the receivers that are being receiving signals up here in 10, or, you know, other communications? What does it do to the noise floor? That's probably what I was really getting at with the question I was asking. It sounds like you sort of answered it in a roundabout way.
And from my point of view, you've been asking the question in a very roundabout way. The signal the question becomes quite a bit easier to answer when you talk about a particular signal like a digital television over-the-air broadcast signal, which is almost exactly 6 megahertz wide, and it's a very flat-top signal. So there we have a definite noisy-like signal with a definite bandwidth and a definite power distribution across that bandwidth. Now when it comes to communication-type signals that have got trunking and digital data and whatever connected to them, each of those signals has different amounts of bandwidth, and in some cases, a different amount of fall off from the center. In other words, it's not a box head, you know, a flat top-like signal. Many of these digital signals have much different waveforms that you'll see on the spectrum analyzer screen. You still, if it's a signal that has significant modulation rate to it, so it's occupying a 10 kc, 50 kc, 100 kc of bandwidth, you could, from center out to the edges, anywhere along that waveform you see on your spectrum analyzer screen, how strong are you getting that signal? You could rate it, if you wanted to, in dBc per hertz units, depending on what bandwidth you use on the spectrum analyzer. Assuming you're using a narrow enough bandwidth, the res bandwidth of the analyzer, let me drop. Assuming you're using a narrow enough res bandwidth on the analyzer so you can see the true shape of the signal. If I've got a digital-like signal with some data on it, where the real signal is primarily 10 kHz or so wide, and if I made the mistake of viewing that with a 100 kHz res bandwidth, my signal on the screen will look like it's 100 kHz wide. In reality, it might really be 10 kHz wide. So you got to be a little bit careful on choosing the right bandwidth to make the measurement before you can rate various portions of the signal in noise power density, dBc per hertz. That's called a noise power density measurement for that particular center frequency or that particular amount of offset from center. Does that help at all, Joe? With E2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Do you feel your question has been answered? It's okay if we proceed to the next person. Wait for the beeps and give us that answer. answer. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, no, I don't, but I guess you can just go to the next person and I'll just have to wing it, I guess.
Okay, you sound like you're a little bit dissatisfied. Are you able to word what you really want? Give us all the real information in the beginning and tell us what portion of that didn't seem to make sense. Over to you, Joe. I'll wait for the beeps, please.
I thought I asked the question properly. I told you, you know, from what I've observed, you know, using different type of analyzers, two different ones I used, and it was a question related to what is it really? I guess really, what does it do? How does it raise the noise floor in the receiver that's receiving the narrow band type of signal it's intended for when you have another signal across its frequency entirely that's occupying much, much more bandwidth, but coming in normally a lot stronger than it does come in because propagation changes. That's what I was sort of getting at. It didn't sound like you were directly answering what I was asking, so it's a little different than what I'm looking for. What does it do to your noise floor, and how much does that interfere with the on-channel signal already by having this extraneous signal come in that's occupying much, much more bandwidth?
If I'm using a properly operating spectrum analyzer, most of the spectrum analyzers that cover VHF, UHF frequencies have a noise floor. If you're using the 1 meg resolution bandwidth, quite often you'll see the noise floor at approximately minus 70 dBm on the screen. As you go from the 1 meg filter to the 100 kc filter, the noise goes from minus 70 to minus 80. As you go from the 100 kc to the 10 kc, it goes to minus 90. So the basic noise figure of your spectrum analyzer tends to stay constant. The noise floor you see at the bottom of the spectrum analyzer moves to lower and lower numbers when you use more and more narrow filter. Basic broadband noise, whether it's coming from the environment or from your own front-end preamplifier, behaves in that manner. Now, when a noisy signal or a signal with a particular bandwidth comes along, Mother Nature always adds noisy signals in a power relationship. If the noise power apparent on your spectrum analyzer screen was minus 80 dBm when using the 100 kc res bandwidth, and if the signal coming into your receiver also had noise power at that region of minus 80 dBm, the two noise powers would add together. You'd measure minus 77. It would be 3 dB louder. If it's thoroughly random noise of your spectrum analyzer mixing with what looks like thoroughly random noise of the signal, they add in that power relationship if they're unrelated. If the signal is a pure CW signal, then it adds more.
Repeater, timeout.
Pure CW signals add in a voltage manner. If I had a pair of signals being mixed together with a good power divider, and the two signals are both on exactly, we'll say, 100 megahertz, the voltage of signal A and the voltage of signal B would add together in a vector manner. If they were both exactly in phase, mix the two signals, you'd get a 6 dB increase, twice the voltage, which is 4 times the power increase. If it's a noisy signal, they add in a power relationship.